This episode of Will Work for Purpose is a little different. Today, I'm not interviewing anybody, but rather just sort of talking about some ideas I've been thinking about. Those include logotherapy, finding meaning in life, and sort of where you can begin to make the world a better place. So, if you're interested in any of that, please stick around and offer your impressions of the show. It is a little different, like I said. And without further ado, here is the 10th installment of the Will Work for Purpose podcast. So today's episode is obviously a little different. I didn't have anyone that was available for an interview this week, so I figured I'd just kind of come on and talk a little bit about something that I've personally been thinking about a lot and kind of expound on some of the other ideas that I've had. Just sort of not in an interview environment and just kind of talk sort of openly and directly to some of the things that I've mentioned in previous episodes, and then also a lot of the concepts that I've been thinking about in my personal life, and then also in like my academic studies and things like that. And I think we can just kind of get into it. So one of the things that I've been looking at, reading about, watching lectures on, talking about with anyone who's willing to listen is this idea of the will to meaning, or this idea that meaninglessness has sort of become pervasive and widespread. And I'm by no means the first person to make this sort of realization. Like, there's a good amount of backing in the scientific literature and studies done on the sense of purposelessness among people and its effects on the individual's mental health. And it's quite devastating. But even before me, there was someone who sort of popularized this line of thinking and wrote a best-selling book called Man's Search for Meaning. And that book was written by a guy named Viktor Frankl. And Viktor Frankl was a psychiatrist and a neurosurgeon who survived the Holocaust. And in surviving the Holocaust, he produced this type of therapy called logotherapy. And he also wrote several best-selling books, most notably Man's Search for Meaning, and then another book which was later rebranded as Man's Search for Ultimate Meaning, which was previously titled The Unconscious. I think it was called The Unconscious God or something like that. But most people wouldn't purchase, a book like that. It's much more spicy, I guess, to sell and buy a book called Ultimate Search for Meaning. So it makes sense that it was rebranded. But anyways, Viktor Frankl and this idea of logotherapy essentially, that word logo or logos is from the Greek, which just means a purpose. And then therapy is obviously like that, the type of therapy that we all come to understand through like the psychodynamic or psychoanalytic approach, but which has kind of shifted over time into more of a cognitive behavioral approach. Most therapists nowadays recognize or self-prescribe the identity of cognitive behavioral therapists. Some like 60% of all therapists are CBT therapists, which cognitive behavioral is, it's more focused on like cognitions, which everyone has, thoughts and feelings, and then behaviors. And so the idea is if you can kind of change these thoughts, you can change behaviors, and sometimes you can change behaviors and change thoughts. And it's like it's more focused on like practical gain, and it's more evidence-based than like sort of the psychodynamic approach or the psychoanalytic approach. And not that those other approaches don't work, like the classic sitting on the couch and talking about your mother. They do work for a lot of people, but for like anxiety issues, which a lot of people are facing right now, CBT is highly effective. Like, for instance, an example of CBT would be there's a therapy practice called flooding, where you basically overload the patient with the stimulus that causes them the greatest anxiety. So, for instance, if you have social anxiety, you tell them to go into, a crowded mall, or you have them go to a social event without their cell phone, or something like that. You basically overload them with the negative stimulus and allow them to sort of become used to it. It's sort of like healing through over familiarity. And if the idea is, if you kind of experience this, you can reduce the ideally what you would do is you would also at the same, you would provide some soothing mechanism. You build up to, you know, the major overflow of the negative stimulus. So like, you may not start by sending someone who's socially anxious to a major party. You might just have them start by sitting in your room in your therapy lounger and you know, asking them to imagine going to a party with people they don't know, and like as you monitor them and as they experience their anxiety symptoms, you have them develop soothing mechanisms. Maybe that's counting to 10, or you know, thinking happy thoughts, or whatever the self-soothe mechanism might be. And the idea is that you steadily increase their threshold in such a way that they can then go to a party with all those people, and they are loaded with all these tools to keep them calm and cool as they undergo what would have been almost a traumatic event for them. But this logotherapy that Viktor Frankl developed is considerably different because it has to deal with meaning and purpose. And the idea, and this is actually something, this is something that is also well documented, you know. So it's like, in the case of, so I'm in a child trauma psych class, and in that class they talk about ways in which you can overcome trauma and traumatic events, and how you can sort of internalize and conceptualize tragedy in your life in such a way that it won't precipitate symptoms or like post-traumatic stress or some other toxic stress-related disorder. One of the ways, or one of the important factors in sort of minimizing the effects of trauma in your life, is being able to apply a framework of meaning to trauma, right? So from the religious point of view, one of those things may be like, God is putting me through a test, or this is a common one I think I hear Christians use, is something like, we were promised troubles, you know, or, you know, it's one of those things to be expected in life, you know. I think overall the general religious point of view is the idea that life is in some way fundamentally going to involve suffering. And so that kind of helps them conceptualize like that, one, they're not unique in their suffering, that all people suffer. This is a quote by Viktor Frankl. He says that suffering is like a gas. It fills the vessel that it enters, you know, and that it doesn't matter what the suffering is necessarily. Like, it's in some sense relative. I would add that while suffering is relative, and the sufferer who experiences whatever they're going through is justified in all their feelings towards that suffering, you know. So for instance, someone who has a cancer diagnosis, that's a pretty traumatic diagnosis. And then likewise, something that would also, you know, be equally traumatic maybe is like getting in a car crash. But it's hard to say, you know, cancer diagnosis is the same as a car crash, because a car crash is like, it's temporary, it's not chronic, it doesn't always kill you, you know, it may be inconvenient, but like, they're both equally tragic things, and we wouldn't say you have no right to feel sad or anxious because your suffering is different. Now, though suffering, I think, does fill the individual, like it is, it's unique and relative and totally dependent on the individual, I do think that and Viktor Frankl refers to it as a gas, and so I would say that while the gas does fill the vessel, I think the potency of the gas differs on the severity of the suffering, you know. So for instance, someone who gets a cancer diagnosis, well, that's a pretty potent gas, I'd assume, while someone who gets maybe something like a carpal tunnel diagnosis, or maybe like a broken leg, let's say broken leg, you break your leg, that's that's a fair amount of suffering, but I don't think it's as potent as a cancer diagnosis. Of course, all suffering can progress, and like maybe the bone break gets worse and infected, and you're getting amputated and all of that. But again, it's still, it's sort of different, and, you know, in there, it's different in obvious ways and then in some more subtle ways, but it's hard to tell. It's hard to tell, you know, you can't really quantify what, which suffering weighs more, or, you know, however you'd want to quantify that, which sort of kind of goes back to this trauma class again. They teach that all trauma is inherently complex. And that idea, the complexity of trauma, kind of speaks to the idea that traumatic events have a multiplicity of variables, and frequently it also refers to the reoccurrence of traumatic events. So like someone experiences like 10 traumatic events, that would be considered someone who's undergone complex trauma, and because each traumatic event interfaces with the individual's understanding of the world, their own neurobiology, their physiology. It interfaces with them at sort of their behavior, their affect, everything. It interfaces with them at sort of every level they exist on. And you can't really narrow down to what degree each of those are affected by each event. And so they came up with just calling everything, all these traumatic events, what, complex or complex traumatic events. But to get kind of back to Viktor Frankl and his logotherapy, he talks about, provided you can develop a sense of meaning, you can endure any amount of suffering, and that it's the meaning in your life that is the most important thing when it comes to your suffering. And so, like, he uses his own experiences in Auschwitz to talk about the types of people who committed suicide and those who didn't commit suicide. And he said those who had found a why to live were able to endure. And he quotes Friedrich Nietzsche saying, Nietzsche said something to the effect of, any man who has a why to live can endure any how, which means something like, so long as you have a purpose in life, you can sort of persist through any circumstance. So like if you were like soldiers, they have a mission, a goal, they know what they're supposed to do. Their actions are infused with meaning, and so they're able to parachute into enemy-occupied territory, and they're able to, you know, do all these sometimes awful things, both awful to themselves and awful to other people. They're sort of able to do this because of the intense amount of meaning that's in their profession. Like they're not able to operate without understanding or without this sense of duty, purpose, etc. And so, like, the idea is that you would act like that in your everyday life. You know, you would live in such a way that whenever you were confronted with naked existence, as Frankl would say, you would be able to persist through that. So if you were thrown into Auschwitz, you would still have a reason to live, you know. And he often, he has this one really touching moment in his Man's Search for Meaning, in the autobiographical portion, where he talks about the moment he found his purpose, and he says that something to the effect of what Dostoevsky says, which is, through love man will be saved, and for him it was through the love of his wife. That's what he would focus on constantly while he was, you know, digging up frozen ground, marching in parade through snow and ice. Whatever he was doing it while thinking of his wife, and while he was sort of meditating on that, thinking about what he would say to her, and, you know, how their reunion would go. Though unfortunately later, it doesn't say it in the book, but she was one of the people who died in the Holocaust. She was a casualty. But he said that, his strength and devotion to her would have persisted and did obviously persist through death. He had no reason to believe that she was alive because he was separated from her from the get-go. And so the idea is that you would find something, I don't want to say metaphysical, but like transcendental or transcendent, something that transcends the physical, because it's important that your purpose is not what will be called corporeal or material, because material things can be taken from you. So if your purpose in life is to develop large amounts of wealth or accumulate wealth to, you know, some unholy degree, or to build bigger and bigger houses or whatever it is, like maybe if you commit yourself to the abstract idea of wealth or the abstract idea of what a big house might be, meaning like you could be the idea that you could be wealthy so long as you had exactly what you wanted, you know. So like that would be a redefinition of wealth that might fit, because you can always change what you want. You know, there's two ways to get what you want. You can either change it, or you can obviously actually go out and get it. So if you want a big boat, you can go out and buy it, obviously, or you can say, my dinghy is a big boat to me. It's the biggest boat I've ever owned, you know, and it's a 2x12, you know, little raft, but it's all I ever wanted or I ever could need, you know, something like that. But typically the idea like of a transcendent purpose or a purpose which transcends the material world would be something like the love of your wife, the love of God, the love of country, like, or you can obviously have evil goals too. So it's important to note that meaning and purpose are relatively amoral. You can have evil purpose or a good purpose. You know, your purpose could be to save puppies and children, or it could be to enslave and brutalize millions of people, you know. So and purpose is individual, although I would say that like the goal, and I've talked about this in some of my other videos and interviews, where I think that the way purpose is made manifest in your life, or the way that you find your purpose in life, it's sort of like a twofold thing. So there's a meta purpose, and then there are particular individual purposes or meanings in life, right? So like your meaning in life isn't some, there's one universal one that everyone can ascribe to. And then there are individual ones which are particular to each individual or each person. So for example, the meta purpose would be something that I would call, and has been called before, the imitation of Christ. And if you're secular, you can just say the imitation of a maximally good ideal. Okay. And so, but for me, I'll choose this facsimile of Christ here. So the idea is that you can always be virtuous at any time in your life. And that's what the imitation of Christ is. It's to be the most it's to be like godlike, essentially, you know. It's to be the most virtuous you can be at any given moment. So any person with any faculty or any understanding at any point in their life can do that. There are virtues which you can practice alone or in public, whether you're employed or unemployed, whether you're educated or uneducated. You can always imitate Christ in any circumstance. Or you can always be virtuous in any circumstance, whether, like I did mention those circumstances before. And then there's particular purpose, which would be like your vocation. So that would be like your employment or what you do during the day, particularly to make money or survive, you know. And that vocation or that job or that individual purpose is something that should actualize, which means to bring into being or make real or to make actual, as many of your gifts, skills, talents, and abilities as possible, right? So if, like, let's say that you're a 25-year-old man, you've trained as an architect, you have some underlying business skills because you started some little side projects with your friends, and you are good at networking, then it might make sense to start an architecture firm or be a consultant for architecture firms or, you know, just be an architect. Like, just being an architect might actualize a large number of your skills. And it's also important to note that that the particular purpose is not like a concrete one that can shift over time as your skills and talents develop. You want to be actualizing more of them as you develop more of them. And sometimes the environment that you develop those skills in aren't necessarily the best place to actualize those skills. So you may start out as an office assistant and you may learn budgeting, payroll, you may learn client relations, you may learn all these things, which, yes, you've used them in your office assistant job, but to better actualize them may mean becoming an actual business owner or CFO or CEO or, you know, something that uses more those skills to a higher degree and more regularly, along with all the other skills that you have. And so, but the goal of like, so the goal of logotherapy is in some sense to help people develop that individual purpose. The meta purpose, I think, is often left out, although it can be helpful. Viktor Frankl frequently talks about, who is essentially the father of logotherapy, he essentially talks about the idea that, like, he counsels camp inmates in Auschwitz, and he tells them, basically kind of gives them a universal purpose in some sense, which kind of trickles down into an individual purpose. So he says something like, a camp inmate comes to him and says, "I can't get anything out of life anymore. I've been brutalized, beaten, abused. I can't, there's nothing I can get from life anymore. I'm going to commit suicide." And Viktor Frankl essentially says something along the lines of, "Yes, but life is not done getting anything out of you. There may be something in the world that you have yet to do for it." And then the guy comes to a realization that he knows that he has family in another country that made it out alive, and so he chooses to live for their sake rather than his sake, and turning his will outward and his affect and everything and focusing on this external source allows him to essentially and ultimately not commit suicide. And so that's sort of like a universal conceptualization of purpose, because the idea is universal. You could apply it to anybody. Life is not done getting anything out of you, getting everything out of you, you know. And you may ask, well, why the hell do I need to get, you know, allow life to get everything out of me? And it's sort of, and that's a, you know, a really good question. Why do you owe life anything? You know, in some sense you could answer like, well, because existence is preferable to non-existence, you know, and we kind of prove that every day by voluntarily existing, you know, well, since the moment you're born. Well, maybe I'd say from like, once you kind of reach a certain threshold in the developmental process, your existence becomes voluntary. Every day you wake up and you choose not to run your car off the road. You choose to persist through the day as you do. And so in some sense, that's evidence for our preference towards existence, and existence itself is considered in philosophy to be a perfection, and non-existence is a privation. And so it's just something that, you know, you could answer it that way. There, you know, this question has been passed around for since it's been thought of, you know, and I'm probably not going to add anything new to the conversation other than the fact bringing it up here might allow you to think about it at the very least, which is important. Thinking about these issues is one of the most important things you can do in your daily life. The ancients used to have this phrase, memento mori, which was kind of picked up by the Stoics, but essentially it means that it means to remember your mortality. And so they would carry tokens around with them, like typically a coin or something to that effect, which they could hold and remember that they are going to die, that their death is before them every day. And in this series I'm working on, actually, which I'm covering this book called The Imitation of Christ. And that in that book, it's essentially just like, it's like a common prayer book or a Christian meditation book. And they have those meditation on mortality or death. And it's important to think about that because it really helps you frame your life. You know, if you think back to the idea that having a framework of meaning allows you to conceptualize traumatic events, so your own death can itself be sort of traumatic when you realize it. You know, I remember the first time I thought that I was going to die, and I was 8 years old, and it was I was an 8 year old kid, and when you're that young, like, the tears can often flow easy, you know, and so I would just cry and cry and cry because I was going to die. And it's and now, since I've been essentially thinking about it since 8 years old, and now I'm 25, I've almost been thinking about it for 20 years, you know, and not, it wasn't always like sophisticated thoughts. Most of the time it was just like, oh my gosh, I'm going to die, I'm going to die, I'm going to die, I'm going to die, you know, and just like that, it was more anxious and fearful. And only now, as I'm starting to get older, I'm able to conceptualize it, abstract it, you know, think about it more realistically in some sense, or more cool and calmly. And it doesn't affect me nearly as bad as it did when I was a child, although it's still, you know, it can still rattle you. It rattles anybody. But it, nevertheless, it's better to be rattled. Ignorance is not bliss, you know, because whether you like it or not, it will eventually come for you, you know. And so it's important to meditate on it, especially like in light of COVID. COVID did that for a lot of people. It brought mortality before our very eyes. It showed us on the world stage that none of us are invincible, that even in the Western world, plague and famine in some sense could strike us here. You know, people with the whole toilet paper thing, like all of a sudden no one could go buy paper products. And that rattled a lot of people out in the West. You know, in the East, people face that more frequently. And even in some states in the West, or at least in the America, sorry, feel that, you know, whereas homelessness is a bigger problem. But a lot of like the smaller areas in America, or even some of the more advanced places in America, thought that they were in some sense invincible, and they could live as they chose, without any repercussion or, you know, any thought for themselves or other people, you know. And so with the advent of COVID, the pandemic, that was sort of stripped away. And even the blinders that we use to hide ourselves eventually lost their flavor, you know, since it lasted so long. Initially, in the beginning, in March, when my state started to do shelter-in-place laws and things of that nature. The first month or so of the shelter-in-place was very easy, you know, like we had all the distractions in the world that were essentially, we didn't have time for because of all the things we had to do in our life. But once all those things we had to do in our life, all those little busy activities were stripped away, we just got to dig into our hobbies and hang out and kind of do the little things at home that we like to do for fun. And that works for a little while. That works for maybe a month or two. And then as those stop becoming interesting, and some things will always be interesting. I read a lot of books during the shelter in place time, and like that was always interesting to me. But like watching Netflix or playing games on my computer became less interesting because I was able to do them more frequently. And I think that maybe happened with a lot of people. A lot of people had these things. Most people watch Netflix, Hulu, etc. And I think that, you know, once they ran out of shows to binge and then re-binge and then re-re-binge, they sort of kind of ran out of these things to hide their face from the world and their thoughts and their families. Because that was another thing COVID did. It brought all the families together in one place, centralize them and force them to interact with each other. which was a shock for some people, and for other people it was a delight. And then for some it was a shock, then it was a delight, or it was a delight, then it was shock, you know. And some people were deeply affected by that, and a lot of families, I think, for the better. Whether you had a bad reaction or a good reaction, the fact that you were able to have the reaction at all is good, because you otherwise would not have had that moment or time to make those realizations with your family. Whether you found that your children didn't like you or didn't even know you, or you didn't know your children, more likely, or you didn't know your spouse, or, you know, the list goes on. COVID sort of stripped all that away. It stripped all the frills away. You know, it really, the modern person hadn't up until this point been faced with something so drastic, like their own mortality and the fragility of their environment. Whereas the ancient or the medieval person was always under threat, you know. Life to them was never normal. There was never a new normal. There was never anything like that that they could have or get back to or come from, you know. It just didn't exist because their existence was always under threat, whether from siege, plague, famine, you name it. It could have been anything at any moment which ruined, which threatened their whole existence. It's only been, you know, the past couple hundred years, really since the advent of modern medicine and the way that we know it now, that we've been able to sort of forget the fragility of life. And that fragility is, it was always there, no matter how developed we are, no matter how much medicine we have under our belts and how much knowledge we have, the fragility is always there, and it always will be there. Nature itself is fragile, and that's important to always keep in front of your mind, along with your mortality, that not only are you going to die, but really all things are going to die, you know, and that in some sense is a tragic thing, but in another sense it's not, because temperance is something that's important, right? Like the temporal nature of our lives and of things oftentimes can make things valuable, right? Although time alone doesn't always make something valuable or invaluable. Diamonds are relatively timeless by our scale, and they're incredibly valuable because they'll exist long after we're gone. But we're only here for, you know, I think the longest living person is 120 years old, so max 120 years right now. I'm sure that will increase with modern medicine and the develop of all the new science and technology. But the time will still be limited, at least by the age of the universe. So long as if we became mortal here, then the universe itself won't be mortal. There's a finite amount of energy in the universe, and, you know, there's this idea that the world is winding down, you know, that eventually all suns will cool and the universe will suffer a heat death. There'll be no energy to sustain life anywhere in the universe. And like I'd said, you know, That's not necessarily, like I said, it's one part tragedy and one part not, you know. Temperance can give value, you know. So, like, if you know you only have a few moments with someone, those moments are the most valuable moments you have. And it's important that you recognize that you're having those moments when you're having them. And I guess my point is that you're always having those moments. You always only have a few moments with anybody, a few minutes with anybody, a few hours, a few days, a few years with all the people that you meet. And whether you believe in an afterlife or not, though, that's an important thing to always keep in front of your mind. It's been shown empirically to increase your empathy, your kindness, your ability to deal with other people, like meditating on those thoughts. And I say meditating and not rumination, because there's a bad way to think about those thoughts, which causes mental distress and can cause you to have issues and develop, you know, anxiety disorders. and things like that, which you don't want to do. You don't want to ruminate on them. You don't want them to become parasitic thoughts, but you do want them, you do want to think about them. I don't necessarily always recommend thinking about them late at night because it'll definitely impede your ability to sleep, which will also cause some issues. You know, like lack of sleep is probably cause for most of our psychotic tendencies, or you know, most of our mental issues. You know, but thinking about them in the daytime at lunch, or talking about them with a good friend, or with your therapist, or professor, like that's you know, very important to do, and you'll be glad you did it, because those meditations allow you to, those meditations allow you to drill down and really help you understand what your role to play here is, what your purpose is, where you can find meaning in your life. And again, those are some of the most important things you do. You know, people who have a purpose or meaning in life benefit immensely from it, both practically, like as far as like life satisfaction, marital satisfaction, rates of lower rates of depression, suicide, etc. Like, but also like metaphysically and spiritually, and there are a lot of these immaterial gains that you can have. Like from developing these, developing meaning in your life, both individual and universal. And it also just, it just makes you, it makes you the type of person people want to be around, you know, and you can alleviate some of that suffering in the world. Developing meaning in your life, in some sense, though I had mentioned before that meaning is amoral, individual purpose or meaning can be amoral or immoral and moral. So it can be good or bad. But provided you're following the meta ethic or the meta purpose, which is the imitation of Christ, or if you're secular, the imitation of the maximally good ideal, which you have to define for yourself, which may be a bit more tricky. You will become the type of person that can be a light in the world rather than a blight in the world. And like that's the most important thing you can do. You won't cure world hunger. You won't stop the heat death of the universe. You won't stop climate change. You're not going to do that by, you're not going to do that by yourself. You're not going to do that in your lifetime, you know. So it's important to work away at limited objectives. It's important to work away at the happiness of your neighbor, of your spouse, of your children. You know, there's this ancient story called the Epic of Gilgamesh, and Gilgamesh is a, it's a Mesopotamian flood story, but essentially, it's the follows this guy named Gilgamesh, and he's a, he's like a larger than life, kind of like a Hercules figure. He's a demigod, and he's basically really, he's a king as well. And he, his king, his subjects can't keep up with him. Like for his appetite for war and sex and all this stuff is like superhuman, and like he's just exhausting all the people around him. And so the gods make him a partner named Enkidu. And they go off and they slay the bull of heaven. They do all these wild and fantastical things. They do a bunch of missions and all this stuff. And eventually it comes to the death of Enkidu. He's struck down, and it strikes Gilgamesh so hard that he, it says in the story that he holds him until a maggot drops out of his nose, basically. Like it, he holds him until he starts to decay, basically. And then he goes off to try and defeat death itself. He goes off and ventures into the underworld and tries to find a way to resurrect Enkidu. And along the way, he meets this really wise old guy that's apparently the only person who had ever gained immortality. And he talks with Gilgamesh, and he says, What are you doing, man? Like, you have a whole kingdom to run. Why are you doing these silly missions for vainglory, essentially? Like, you're not, you have responsibility, you have things you need to do, people that depend on you. Like, the best thing you can do right now is not to try and win this selfish victory. The best thing you can do is go back and defend your kingdom, build a legacy there. Don't try to win this win your legacy through vainglory, because that was essentially his mission in setting out. He wanted to win a name for himself. And this guy kind of sets him straight, and he's like, basically, go take care of your family, go take care of your wife, your children. Like, stop trying to cure world hunger, stop trying to stop climate change, by yourself, in one weekend. Instead, focus on the things within your immediate vicinity. And so he goes back to Uruk, which is the kingdom he runs, and he builds the walls of Uruk. And that's where he gets his legacy, basically. He says, something like, these walls will be my legacy, or this will tell the story of who I am. And so, paying attention and helping those people around you and becoming a better, more well-rounded version of yourself through the development of individual meaning and purpose, and the precipitation of virtue. Those things will allow you to, like I had mentioned before, heal the world. And the healing begins in your immediate vicinity, with limited objectives. Set out to fix Bill, whatever, XYZ, like, if that bill is bad, right? Like, that's a limited objective. Like, working away in, like, local government, or in your school or employer, or your work, where you work, like, working away to make those places better. Like, everything has a ripple effect. Like, if you help your children grow up to be good, virtuous, empathetic, kind, compassionate, loving people, you can't even measure the impact that has on the world. And likewise, loving your mother, your father, the random guy on the street, like, treating them with the utmost respect and dignity, and all of that. Like, you can't possibly imagine the effect that has on the world. And that's kind of all has to begin with, if anything, that you get from this talk. Just that I've been rambling on, but if you get anything out of it, get that. If even if you don't know what your individual or even your universal purpose is, just begin by being compassionate, empathetic, and respectful. And you may need those defined for you. You may be a relativist. You may not think that there are any absolute versions of compassion, empathy, or dignity, or respect. And you can go out and search. That at least gives you somewhere to begin. Go look out for, start reading, watching videos, listening to podcasts, figure out what those things are, and maybe that's where you begin. And I think now is as good a place as any to end this episode. So thanks for watching. It was a bit different. Please let me know what you think, if this was interesting, or you want to see me do more of this. This was sort of just off the top of my head, and so maybe there'll be I could do more structured ones in the future. But yeah, thanks for watching, and I'll see you in the next one. Thank you for taking the time to listen to this episode of the Will Work for Purpose podcast. If you liked what you heard here, you can find the podcast wherever major podcasts are found, as well as YouTube. So you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, YouTube, Stitcher, etc. Wherever you listen to your podcast, you can find this podcast. If you want to support the work that I'm doing, subscribing is a good way to help, or you can check out the merch store, and the link for that will be in the description below, and you can buy this sweatshirt that I've been wearing, which is the anti-nihilism, or the anti-meaninglessness sweatshirt. So thanks for watching. Leave your impressions of the show in the comments below, or wherever you happen to be listening to this. And if you want to be on the podcast yourself or want me to interview someone, you can contact me at mosley@tweakingo.com. And you can find the rest of my work at tweakingo.com. Again, thanks for listening, and I'll see you in the next one.